This is Life Matters Summer and I'm Cassie McCullough and we're on a hat trick of spirited women this morning. Our third guest is Marina Goh. She's had a stellar career as a magazine journalist, editor and manager. But getting to the top of her profession hasn't been a polished path. When I spoke to her, I asked her which magazine had the most influence on her as a young girl.
I have. I certainly started publishing during the golden years. I think that's appropriate to say. And, you know, I've had a very rich and rewarding career, a very entertaining one too.
Yes, we'll get to some of the extraordinary moments that you've detailed in this book, which is really sort of part how to negotiate this world, how to find a way through and bits of advice that you've learned, as well as moments of memoir. Mm-hmm. You got yourself onto a paper after heading into a career in banking for a year, and that wasn't lighting your fire at all. Mm-hmm. And Dolly magazine was always on your radar. And it was Lisa Wilkinson, who was also an editor of Dolly, that kind of was part of ushering you into that world. Tell us about growing up with Dolly and becoming editor of it.
So I read Dolly passionately. I was almost the ultimate reader. So, you know, when you're a magazine editor, what you want is you want a reader to know when the next issue's on sale and be there at the front of the newsagent when it opens on the day, and that was me, right? So I loved it as a teenager. I think I learned a lot from it. So it provided me with a lot of advice and confidence, really. And Lisa Wilkinson was the editor at the time when I read Dolly. So I made a decision when I was 16 that was what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to be the editor of Dolly, which is a very strange, probably very specific career choice because I didn't say, oh, I want to be a journalist. I wanted to be the editor of Dolly. Mm. And I was very fortunate that through a number of correct decisions, I guess, and, you know, and backing myself really, which is one of the bits of advice I give young women, that I was able to achieve my dream when I was 23. So, you know, I feel very fortunate.
Mm. And you were there for a while and you outlined taking a sort of meagre salary back in the early 90s, I think it was $40,000
right.
or something, which you could barely pay for the kind of accoutrements expected of the editor of a magazine like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's one of the challenges of publishing in general and certainly with fashion magazines it doesn't get any easier because, you know, you have these very talented young women who are on a relatively small pay compared to the sorts of labels, I guess, they're expected to wear when they go to events. And but, you know, we just made the best of it. I think the great thing about Dolly was that it was just a really fun team. And you know, you are still in a fortunate position compared to the rest of society in that you do still get sent, you know, free music and free books and free makeup and that sort of thing. So we were able to kind of patch our lives together with that. But we were really living on the smell of an oily rag. You get to go and see free movies, that kind of thing. But, yeah, you know, I wouldn't change it for anything. Yeah. And the money wasn't the thing. You know, that's the great thing about and unfortunately for me, it never has been. I've never been driven by the reward of money. But certainly that was lucky in the early days.
You reminded me of Anne Hathaway in The Devil Wears Prada, working for the demon boss.
Yes.
Now, you know, your family is a fascinating story. Your mother, Italian, gorgeous, totally gorgeous, and you describe her so beautifully in the book. And your father is Chinese, but Indonesian Chinese.
Well, no, he's actually Chinese, but his family moved to Indonesia when they all fled communism, you know, back in the day. So dad grew up in Hong Kong, actually, with his foster parents, but his real family, and, you know, as I describe in the book, that dad had a situation where he went to live with a foster family. His father lost him in a game of mahjong. But he used to go back to Indonesia all the time. And so he can speak Indonesian as well as four different dialects of Chinese and English. Mm. So he's quite an impressive
incredibly
man.
Talented. And as you say, this incident with the mahjong game is just, I mean, it's defies belief partly because it, you know, destroyed.
It's because it's true.
It's because it's true.
Yeah.
And your grandmother, well, his mother didn't know why this person had turned up to collect the son that she'd just given birth to.
And you can't imagine, can you? And so as a mother, I can't even fathom the concept that somebody, that I'd be forced to give my child away because of a promise that my husband made to somebody. And, you know, in the Chinese culture as then as it is now, is that, you know, your word is your honour. And so she had no choice because her husband gave his word that if he lost that game, the next child born would go to this other woman or this other family, and that was my dad. And so, yes, it's when I first, I didn't know about this until I think I was in my teenage years. It started to kind of piece together, and then certain family members started to tell me about it. And I always thought that, I mean, it really should be its own book, actually. And I've always said to Dad, you know, at some point I need to write that book just for you.
Mm.
But I really wanted to put, you know, chapter one is about my parents. And the reason that I've done that is I think it's really important to see the sort of people that have shaped the person that I am, because there are lots of traits that I have from both of them. And I can see that now as, you know, now that I'm 50, I can look back and see that I get a lot of things from both parents. And I, you know, my father's drive is why I have my drive. I know that.
And is that drive because of this disconnection? Actually, the foster father he had was very sort of violent and
yes.
cruel.
Yes, he was. Yeah, and you know, Dad, I didn't meet him because he died before we ever started going to Hong Kong as young children to visit our grandmother. But my dad fled Hong Kong because he had this foster father who, you know, wasn't his real son, and so yeah, he had no love for him. Whereas his foster mother loved him more than she loved her daughters because of the whole place in society of boys versus girls.
Crazy.
And you know, she. I mean, I didn't think there was anyone in the world who loved my dad more than her. So she was a beautiful woman till the end. But yeah, Dad was, he had a horrible upbringing from a father that was very cruel to him. And that's because he wasn't genetically, you know, his child.
And so he's driven, he worked three jobs as long as you can remember. And you were always chatting to him as he was rushing between his jobs, even in the shower, you know, dad, you know. So you've got this drive, and this is what's in your book. There's this, and I've heard people say about you that it's amazing that you have this resilience, and when things go wrong, you have this absolute kind of ability just to crash through. And in fact, the book is called Breakthrough.
Yeah.
but I notice in your dedication at the beginning, you thank all your girlfriends for the support when you're freaking out and feeling insecure and paranoid or whatever about writing this book. So that did actually surprise me.
Did it surprise you that I was insecure and paranoid?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. Look, I have the same emotions that other people have. I am quite a confident person, and I think the confidence comes from my dad because, you know, from a very young child, yeah, he thought I could be the first female prime minister. Julia beat me to it.
You still might. Well, yeah, I was going to say, you still might have a chance, not
I
the
might
first.
Have a chance to be one. Well, I don't think I want to go into politics, let me tell you. But you know, he had a very strong belief in me, so I had a very strong belief in me, and I think that that's a really important point. But, you know, I still have days where I doubt my ability, and I go through the whole, you know, the whole syndrome that women go through. You know, am I a fraud? Will somebody discover me? And that's the reason why I think I've not just worked, but I've had done two degrees along the way. You know, I worked and studied it along the way. You know, when I became the chair of the West Tigers, I immediately went off and did the role of the chairman course with the AICD because I thought, oh, you know, I better learn how to do it properly. And I know that that's not normal behaviour. But that's what I do, and I think that's what a lot of women do. I'm no different to anybody else. I just, but I'm tough
you
in the
tough.
Face of adversity, and
yeah.
I think that that's happened over the years from me having to face adversity constantly, and you know, from very early in my career. I mean, I had aggressive situations or kind of confrontational situations very early, and you just develop an armour about you, otherwise you can't survive.
Mm. We're talking with Marina Goh, who is a publisher. She's also, as she just mentioned, chair of the West Tigers, the NRL team. We'll get to that in a moment because that's a whole kettle of fish. But this book, Marina, you mean these ideas are very simply laid out, but then you flesh them out with some stories and your own. But I mean, they're like network like crazy. Take risks with your career, acknowledge others, take care of the team. Mm. A lot, you know, has been said about Australia and not having enough women on boards in positions of power. But central to that question is, are they different to men?
Yeah, women think differently, and just like, I mean, you know, diversity isn't just about gender. I just happen to be attacking gender diversity at the moment because that's it's my hot point. But you know, diversity of background as well, and diversity of experience, diversity of race. There are whole different lots of diversity that need to be really attacked, I think, when it comes to boards. But certainly women think differently. We come at it from a different perspective. There's a lot of research to suggest that, you know, our appetite for risk is different. Our interest in detail is different. The way that we approach, you know, the way that we ask questions at board level is different. And that's my experience. You know, I've been on boards with men and women. I've been in leadership teams with men and women. And certainly the best functioning boards that I've been on have a very good mix of both genders. But as I said, that's not the end of it. You know, when there's fuller diversity, so there's also different backgrounds in terms of experiences, you know, people who've grown up with different, you know, even things like location, regional, rural versus urban, and, you know, wealthy, elitist kind of backgrounds versus people who struggled, you know. I mean, you need the full gamut on a board because people have to challenge each other, and you don't challenge somebody who thinks the same way you do.
Yes, and you've written about these boardrooms that are full of 60-year-old white men who have all been to private schools who aren't really able to challenge each other's ideas because they don't have much other experience.
No. And the other thing to consider too is that I guess one of the worrying trends for me is that in taking women on boards, and they're basically saying, "Oh, we need a woman, so let's tick that box." They're gaining women from the same networks, and so they might be a woman, but they still have come from the same sort of private school, the same sort of area. Some of them married to the husbands of the men around the boardroom table, so there are they're also less likely to challenge their view of the world and view of, you know, and a lot of that's about values. It's really important to do that around the board table. It's not just about the numbers.
Mm. And I guess that a part of that is that staying in the box, because it's nice and comfy in the box, is actually a really radically dangerous prospect. You need the insulation, the Teflon coating that comes with knowing exactly what a broad range of people are thinking and how they're likely to behave, whatever your business is. Yeah. Tell us about becoming the chair of the West Tigers. I mean, I know that, you know, a lot of people aren't into rugby league. They're into AFL, so they'll not quite understand that it's just as passionately loved in New South Wales, at least. Mm-hmm. So were you always a footy fan?
So I grew up with a brother who was completely obsessed with rugby league and played rugby league, not at a professional level, but at a school level. And so, you know, I followed the Parramatta Eels when I was a teenager. One of my girlfriends and I used to go and follow the Manly Seagulls around because we happened to fancy a couple of players in the team. So, you know, I'm well aware of the game. It was really when I had my sons, I guess, that, you know, they developed their passion. My husband's a mad rugby league fan, that I decided that I wanted to be a director of a male sports board that required diversity. And so when the idea of rugby league was presented, it really appealed to me because I was familiar with it. I don't know all the rules, though, I'll be really honest. And let me tell you, probably nobody does anymore because they're changing
so
often. But but you know, people sit in the chairman's lounge with me and explain some of the rules to me. But that's not my role. You know, I don't choose the team. I don't choose.
Yeah. Well, part of what you have done is this women's initiative. And what's that about? It's sort of making women feel welcome.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. So I guess we did some research with our members, and we determined that one of the metrics around success with a football club is game day attendance. And our attendance levels were not at the level we wanted. Our membership was not at the level we wanted. So we researched our membership and our fan base. And we determined that there are a lot of women that were saying that they just didn't feel comfortable coming to a game because a lot of the games are very blokey. And sometimes women want to, they don't necessarily come just because they're with a partner. There are lots of women who love rugby league, but they were more comfortable sitting at home watching the game. So we decided that, you know, their view of entertainment and their game day experience is different to to the expectations of a man. And so we're exploring that. Even things like, you know, merchandise, you know, we say, well, why are you not buying as much merchandise? And they're saying, because it's literally, you know, men's styling in a woman's size, and it doesn't look good.
Marina Goh talking about her career, which she's written about in her book, Breakthrough, An Insider's View of the Climb to the Top. Now, Marina is still the chair of the West Tigers Leagues Club, but since we spoke, she's left Bauer Media and has now taken up a job in the car industry with a prestige brand. Always on the go.